Good morning, everyone. Wow, so good to be here. As I expressed last night, very grateful to church for having me. For those of you who were here last night, thank you for coming. For those of you here this morning, I am cognizant of the fact that it's early Saturday morning and a lot of stuff you could be doing this morning. And there's probably a lot of things you're thinking, man, I just got to get this done. And maybe some of you came because you're like, man, I really need to hear this message. I want some new perspective. I want to learn some things. So I'm eager to be there. Maybe some of you came because you're like, oh, I don't want to go to this thing, but you kind of got us. So, okay, let's go. We'll do the grocery shopping in the afternoon instead. All right. And then some of you came because your wife or somebody said, go. That's why I'm here. Somebody just said, come here, and I'm... Anyway, I'm so glad that I am here. It's a real privilege, and I think I was in Charlotte about 5 years ago and preached on a Sunday and did a little workshop on a Sunday afternoon, but it's been so great to be able to spend this amount of time here with you, and I'm actually on a three-week tour of the North Carolina churches, and basically going around all the churches over the next 3 weeks, so it'll be a busy trip, but really glad that I can do that. And I really appreciate the leadership of this church for having the faith and the courage to address the stuff that we're going to be talking about today, because the stuff is really out of the box. They're difficult subjects. They're uncomfortable subjects. Some of these things that we're talking about today are what I believe to be inconvenient truths. They're countercultural. People who don't hold to what we would call the traditional biblical sexual ethic would strongly disagree with us. When I've traveled, I've had people protest me and threaten me. And I've had people yell and scream, and people with rainbows and banners and buttons and attack me. And I'm trusting none of that will happen here today. But if it does, I'm used to it. So I say all that just to say that the stuff we're talking about today, they're not easy things. And so I appreciate the faith and the courage of the eldership and the senior leadership of this church for saying, yeah, you know what? It'll be a tough conversation, and it might be a difficult thing maybe to have Guy Hammond come, but everybody else is talking about this, and we want to be a church that's relevant in our community. And so let's do this. So thank you for doing that. I really, really appreciate it. So the first portion here is going to be a repeat, actually, for those of you who were here last night. And so don't get disgruntled. Just either act like you've never heard it before. So when I say the same jokes over again, you laugh, right? And you act really interested. Or those of you who already heard this first portion, because I'm going to tell my story and where I come from and why I'm here and whatnot. And you're going to be like, oh, yeah, I know already. But that's okay. You guys just talk amongst yourselves. Everybody else will just pay attention, okay? That's great. So let's go ahead and get started. Here's a really good place to start. What does the Bible actually teach on homosexuality? Well, really, the Bible doesn't speak very much about it. We only get basically five scriptures. And here they are here. Except my clicker's not working. So the brain trust in the top there will get that going for me. When I click the green button, does the green arrow on the machine go on? There we go. We're in business, guys. Wow. You guys do not get paid enough. Right? Those guys, I'll tell you, that's the worst job in the world right there. And they have the greatest hearts. Yeah, those guys, you never want to be on their bad side. As the public speaker, they are amazing. You just stay on their good side because they could really mess you up. Oh, yeah? You don't like me? Boom, now you're unconnected. Now what are you going to do? Anyway, okay, so these are the five scriptures. And the Bible does talk about homosexuality in a more roundabout way about 30 times. Stories of like Sodom and Gomorrah, that kind of thing. But in terms of addressing the subject directly, those are the five scriptures, okay? So let's go ahead and just read one of them here so that we can say that we read the Bible this morning. And let's go ahead and read 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 9 and 10. Here's what it says. Don't you realize that those who do wrong will not inherit the kingdom of God? Don't fool yourselves. Those who indulge in sexual sin or worship idols or who commit adultery or are male prostitutes, or practice homosexuality, or are thieves, or greedy people, or drunkards, or are abusive, or cheat people, none of these will inherit the kingdom of God. And so this scripture is not about homosexuality. It discusses homosexuality there, but really this scripture is about the broken human condition. It's about who we all are. And it's in this scripture and in others where God pleads with us. He tries to give us ethics. He tries to give us guidelines and boundaries to say, listen, I love you. I care for you. You're my child. I created you. I formed you. And I am the architect of your life. And I know you so well. I know what will work for you and what won't. I know what will make you happy and fulfilled and truly satisfied. And I know what will destroy your life. And I'm telling you, if you're going to be a drunkard, or if you're going to be a thief, or if you're going to live your life like a greedy person, or if you're going to practice homosexuality, or if you're going to cheat people, listen, this is not how I want my people to live, because you will only be hurting yourself and everybody around you. And so these are guidelines that God is giving us. Homosexual practice is just one of many. And as I said last night, we can all find ourselves somewhere on that list. And so this is just, as I said, one of the five scriptures. Now, even though we only get five, there's quite a bit we can learn from the five, okay? So let's take a look at this. This is really important. We only get five scriptures, but it's important to recognize that we get scriptures both in the Old and the New Testament. It's important to recognize that these scriptures were written thousands of years apart between Leviticus and what Paul started writing in Romans. It's important to recognize that these scriptures were written to highly different cultures, to different audiences, and even written in different languages. That's really important, because today people will say, well, Guy, you can't trust what the Bible says on sexual ethics. I live in Charlotte and it's 2019 and that stuff was written thousands of years ago. And so the Bible is not reliable on sexual ethics, so I don't have to follow that. I mean, if you're going to tell me that I can't sleep with my girlfriend or my boyfriend, if you're going to tell me that I can't be involved in a gay relationship and that you're using the Bible as your standard, forget it. I'm not going to listen to that stuff. You see, the insight that we receive here is that because these were written throughout the Old and New Testaments, it shows us consistency of how God felt about sexual ethics. From beginning to end, God remained constant. God remained consistent throughout the Bible. It's important to recognize that because it was written over thousands of years, that God's mind didn't change over that period of time. Because it was written to different cultures, we can't claim that how the Bible treats sexual ethics is a cultural thing. Well, that was their culture. That was their time. But this is a different culture. Well, you can't make that argument, because this is written to different cultures. Right? And so it shows us consistency. And the bottom line is, there are just some things scripturally that defy time and culture. And sexual ethics is one of them. How God felt about sexual ethics 4,000 years ago is how God felt about sexual ethics 2,000 years ago. And it's how God feels about sexual ethics today. So these things haven't changed. And so this brings consistency to the message and shows us how God feels about all of these things. Now, this is not a really popular message. And as I said, I've been protested against. I guess I didn't realize when I was starting, actually, this ministry, the kind of vitriol I would receive. The truth is, some of the nastiest comments I've ever received have actually been from Christians. The gay rights movement, yeah, they've attacked me. They've showed up at events that I've gone to. And they'll protest me and yell and scream and threaten me. But I'm telling you, I've had Christians get up and walk out. I've had Christians send me some of the nastiest emails because of how I think we should deal with the issue of homosexuality and how we should reach out to that community and how we should make the church a safe place for these people to come in to learn about Jesus. And a lot of the stuff that I'm going to be talking about, especially in the second class, you might not even agree with. Some of you might be like, yeah, no, I don't like what you're saying there, Guy. That's fine. I'm still trying to figure it out, too. I don't have all the answers, but this stuff is controversial. That sign there that you see, don't listen to Guy, I put that sign there because I was teaching at an event in Maine. It's at a university. And the gay rights movement on campus heard that I was coming. And so they tried to get the thing shut down, and they couldn't. And so they went out and printed all these t-shirts that said, don't listen to Guy, on them, and passed them out en masse to all the students on campus. And so even before I got there, all the students were wearing these dumb t-shirts that said, don't listen to Guy, on them. Of course, they didn't know who Guy was, and they didn't know what Guy was going to say, and they didn't even know why they weren't supposed to listen to Guy, but it was a stupid t-shirt, and the campus students will wear anything, so they did that. So anyway, I started a website called don'tlistentoguy.com, and I've told people if they want to complain and gripe and yell, just go to don'tlistentoguy.com, and you can put it there. But if you have good comments, too, and you're like, Guy, I want to tell you how good you did today, or I have a suggestion for you, here's a better way of dealing with this, I'm wide open. Go to don'tlistentoguy.com, and you can put that stuff right there, and hopefully that will help you. So, as I said, the stuff we're talking about is very multifaceted, right? It's so complex. It's one of the reasons why I think we avoid talking about homosexuality, transgender issues, sexual identity issues. I think one of the reasons why we avoid it is because it's so confusing and so multifaceted. There's so many moving parts. And what we don't understand, we become afraid of. And so most Christians, I find, do not want to talk about this stuff. There's a lot of churches, even within our fellowship, who will not have me come and speak because they're like, we're not opening up that can of worms. That's why I applaud your church for having the courage to have me come and speak, because it's not just like some of the Baptist churches won't have me, or some of the evangelical. Actually, they're the ones who are having me more and more often now. But even some in our own fellowship are like, no. Meanwhile, people in their churches are like, hello, can we talk about this, please? I'm not kidding you. I had an evangelist of a church in our fellowship, over 1,000 members. And he came up to me at some event I was at, and he said, hey, bro, great ministry there. Yeah, good for you. I was like, oh, thanks. He goes, yeah, we don't have anyone like that in our church, but so we don't need you to come to our church, but that's a great ministry. I was like, well, first of all, I don't know what like that means. But then I was like, you're dumb, because I was like, I got like 15 of your members that belong to my ministry. And due to the confidential nature of the ministry, I can't tell you that or who they are. But I got people who belong to your church coming to me for help. I'm helping them. I'm helping the people in your church. But you think you don't have anyone like that in your church. Anyway, he still hasn't invited me, but that's fine. Anyway, my point was, it's controversial. And we become afraid of what we don't understand. So what I'm hoping we can accomplish a little bit today is that maybe I just bring a little bit more understanding to the topic so that maybe you're not as afraid to discuss it. And maybe I can give you some terminology or some bridge-building language, I like to call. So you can go, okay, I've got a new perspective now. I've got a new way of thinking about this now. And you know, that's all I'm hoping to really accomplish. You're going to leave today with questions that I will not have answers for. I myself have to live within the tension of uncertainty on a lot of the stuff that we're talking about. There's a lot of ambiguity here. I am certain on what I call the traditional biblical sexual ethic. And I would think most of us in here would agree with it, but not everybody. And what is that? I believe that based on the 5 scriptures that we set on homosexuality, but other scriptures surrounding sexuality in general, my understanding of what the biblical sexual ethic is that sexual intimacy is to be reserved between that of a man and a woman bound together only in marriage, and anything outside of those confines is not representative of what God intended for human sexuality. And so, as I said, you know, great, we got some amens. I know, already knew, because I'm in a church. Most of you would agree with that. When I say that statement on a university campus, you should see the crowd go crazy. So I already knew most of us would agree, but there might be some in here who don't. That's fine. I'm so glad you're here. There might even be some people here who are from the gay community, or somebody just invited you and you're like, okay, I'll go to this thing and see what this guy has to say, because you're a pro-gay proponent and you wanted to maybe hear the other side. So glad you're here. I want you to know I don't have all the answers. I like it when things are very clear, black and white, but I have to admit on this stuff, yeah, I don't have it all figured out either. That said, I do have a little bit of history here and a little bit of understanding of what's going on. And here's the one thing I think we can all agree on, okay? I think we all agree on the fact that no matter where we stand, whether you agree with me today on how we should deal with this within the church, in our communities, or even what my stance is on sexual ethics, I think we can all agree on that. I hope we can anyway. Every person needs to be treated with dignity, kindness, and respect, no matter how they decide to live their lives, regardless of what their response is to Jesus and his church, or how they treat us. Every person needs to be treated with dignity, kindness, and respect. I would like to think we all agree there. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. I grew up in a really church-going family, and grew up in the Church of Christ. Dad was a minister in the Church of Christ, and what we would call mainline Church of Christ in Canada. And my mom and dad were really good people, but they found themselves in over a period of years of really getting themselves into a lot of trouble. There was a lot of chaos in my home that nobody knew about. And we lived in a church culture back then that said you're not allowed to let anybody know who you really are. We go to church on Sunday and everybody acts like everything's okay, but nobody's really transparent and open about what's really going on in their lives. And so every Sunday you'd say, how are you? And you'd say, I'm doing great. Doesn't matter that maybe your life is miserable, but you're always acting like everything's okay. It's one of the greatest pitfalls and downfalls of Christianity. Don't let it happen to you, right? Somebody needs to know who you really are. Somebody, you need a safe place to go to be able to be honest and transparent about who you are and what you're going through. My family didn't live that way. My mom had multiple adulterous relationships with many men over a period of many years. And I would go to church on Sunday and my dad would get here. I'm a kid, right? I'm, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. Dad would get up on Sunday and preach. Mom sitting in the front row like the good preacher's wife. She would teach Sunday school and the lady classes and we'd all act like the perfect little Christian family. But we'd go home and my mom was sleeping around with several different men throughout the city. And there's fighting and yelling and screaming and slamming doors and hurt feelings and everyone's freaking out. But we go to church on Sunday and Wednesday and everything's just great. And I have memories of my dad taking me through the city at night trying to find my mom, trying to find what hotel she's in, what man she's with next, and get her out and bring her home. And it was a terrible way to live. During this time, there was a kid, I will mention to you that I was sexually molested by a man when I was 8 years old. And he was a friend of the family, and the family didn't have enough beds in the house. We didn't have enough beds in the house for this guy. I don't know why they didn't just say sleep on the couch, but hey, why don't you sleep with our son, Guy? And he won't mind. This guy was, he would have been like 20 at the time. I was 8. And this guy was kind of like a friend of the family. We knew him. I knew who he was. But yeah, can you just stay in Guy's room? So he raped me. And the next day threatened me, don't you ever tell anyone or I will kill you. Now let's go have breakfast. And I didn't speak about it until I was 35 years old. Never mentioned it out loud to another living person. Told my wife finally when I was 35. When I was around 12, a kid in my neighborhood suggested, he was also around the same age, said, hey, you offered to try to do something sexual. I said, sure, let's try that. And that just opened up a Pandora's box of trouble. And that just became just a regular part of our lives, him and I. His name was Carl. And Carl and I became boyfriends. Now, it's something we couldn't talk about very much. Couldn't talk about to anybody. Some couldn't talk about it very much. Couldn't talk about it to anybody. Different culture back then, 1970s, early 1980s. You didn't go around talking about this kind of thing. You certainly didn't have any outward physical signs of affection. And anyway, he remained my boyfriend until I was 22 years old. And so it was a long-lasting relationship. But I was, because I knew that it was wrong and whatnot, felt really like I wanted to get help, but I didn't know where to go for help. This is a picture of me when I was 19 years old. By then, I was like, I got nowhere to go. I can't talk to my church about it. I can't talk to a teacher about it. I can't talk to my dad about it. He would freak out. So I got nowhere. I got no one. And I would go to bed at night thinking about how little the world seemed to think of me and just like, wow, I'm in serious trouble here. By the time I was 19, I was like, that's it. I'm done with this church thing. So I ended up moving to Toronto. And Toronto's got a large gay population there. And I didn't initially go thinking I was going to be getting involved in all the garbage I got involved into. But, sin never goes upwards. Sin only goes downwards, right? Things only get worse. Whatever you're doing now, if it's unchecked and you're not getting help and you're not being transparent and you're not repenting, trust me, things will only get worse. Things never get better, right? Here I was in Toronto now and I'm there and started having anonymous sexual encounters with strangers and meeting guys in parked cars and public bathrooms, that kind of thing. And there was no internet back then. You just kind of had to know where to go, that kind of thing. So, I don't know. By the time I was 24, I'd acted out hundreds of times with different guys. And I remember just thinking, man, your life is in so much trouble, guy. What are you going to do here? Like, how are you going to get out of this mess? And I'll tell you, the honest truth is that homosexuality was a really good friend to me. It was reliable. It was my safe place, I thought. And it gave me community. It gave me somebody to love and somebody who I thought would love me. Of course, I use the love term there, love, very loosely. You know, like any sin, you know it's wrong, but you go and you do it, and it feels good for only a short amount of time, then you feel really bad. And what do you do to make yourself feel better again? And go right back to the sin again. It becomes this constant cycle, right? And so by the time I was 24, life had chewed me up and spit me out. And I was like, I'm an old man right now, and I'm only 24. Right at that time, a guy that I had gone to high school with had found a new church in downtown Toronto called the Toronto Church of Christ. It's 1985. He said, hey, why don't you come to this church? And I was like, Kevin, I am not going to church. Now, he didn't know about all the homosexual stuff. He just was inviting me to go to church. After a while, I thought, I'm going to go and check this out because I got nowhere else to go. And so I went, and of course, I loved the church. I was so impressed by it and so impressed by the fellowship and the broad range of kinds of people that were there and how kind these people were. And I thought, yeah, you know, maybe this has something, because this is not like the church I grew up in. So I went, and I loved it. But I wasn't going to tell these people who I was, because I was like, if I tell them who I really am, they're going to let me come back. And I love this church, so I'm just going to keep coming. But you know, I'm going to keep coming, but I'm going to keep living my gay life off on the side. And so I did that for about 2 years. And after about 2 years, I couldn't stand the hypocrisy anymore. I was like, oh God, this is ridiculous. Like, you got to stop living this way. And I was like, the only way I'm going to do that is if I tell these people who I really am. And what if they ask me to leave? And I thought, well, I'm just going to risk it. And one of the ministers pulled me aside, one of the evangelists. So he pulls me into his house. He says, come on over. So I want to talk to you. So I go to his place. And he says, you've been coming for 2 years now. We really love you coming to our church. Really want you to become a Christian. He said, you're involved in something. I don't know what it is, but something is up with you. And he said, what? Just tell me what it is. I was like, no, I'm not doing that. His name was Ken. Ken goes, listen, I'm a safe place. You can tell me. Just tell me what's going on. No. It's none of your business. And so I don't know if this is the best way to deal with things, what he did next, but this is what he did. It helped me. He said, listen, let's quit playing church. You're coming out. You're not changing. There's something going on. You don't want to tell me. He said, let's do this. I'm going to count backwards from 10. I'll give you 10 seconds. And either you can start telling me what's really going on and I will help you. Or he said, just, there's the door. Go live your life. Like, quit living both. Go live your life. And he says, if God lets you live through it, he said, maybe you can come back and tell me about it someday. So I'm sitting there at his dining room table. He starts counting. He literally started counting. 10, 9, 8, 7. I don't have to go through all the numbers. You know them, but actually, I'm in the States. 6, 5. Okay. Give this Canadian boy a break. Okay. So anyway, he got to 0 and I was like, that's it. I'm out of here. So I left, went down, got on a city bus. And I was like, I'll never go back to church again. That is it. Finally, I will be myself and I'll live my gay life. I'm done with God and church forever. It's a 20-minute bus ride that changed my life. Because as I was on the bus, this one thought kept going through my mind. Guy, you know Jesus died for you. You know it's a fact. How can you turn your back on that? I just kept thinking about that on that 20-minute bus ride. I had one side of me going, go live your gay life. I had this other side going, guy, Jesus died for you. How are you going to live the rest of your life knowing you turned your back on that? And by the time that bus had arrived in front of my apartment building, I said, I can't turn my back on a man who died for me. Man, this is going to be hard, but I'm going to do it. I got off that bus, went into the apartment, called Ken back up and said, I'm coming back. I told him everything, spilled the beans. Bless his heart, he was like, I'm I'm sure, you know, they had no idea what to do with me. But anyway, we studied the Bible for a couple of weeks. And I was baptized on August 15th, 1987. And I can tell you, I have not one time, I have not participated in any kind of homosexual activity since my conversion on that day. So it's amazing what God has done, and it was. I knew it was going to be difficult. One thing I never thought that would ever happen for me is that I'd get married. I didn't know how that was going to happen, but met a girl in the church, and I knew if I'm going to be a Christian, I got to do it God's way. My wiring, if you want to, whatever you want to call it, says I have to. I'll get my needs met, my relational, emotional needs met by being with a man. That's what I need to be with. If I want to be happy, I need to be with a man, right? But God in the Bible says, "Guy, no, I made you. I know it works. That doesn't work. Don't do that. It'll only make things worse. You need to be with a woman." So it was very counter to everything that I understood, but I just trusted that what God said was true. He made me. He knows. And so I started building a relationship with this girl in the church. We became great friends. Of course, I told her who I really was, told her about my past. By then, I had been sent on a mission team to help plant the church in Detroit. That's where actually I met Rodney and Jennifer the first time. They were a part of the Detroit church at the time. And I was on that mission team planting the church and really started falling in love with Kathy. Of course, I was not attracted to her the way a heterosexually attracted man would be, but she was my best friend. I loved being with her. She was just a joy to be with. And so Kathy and I got married. The clicker's not working in there, guys, if you want to double check that for me. Thank you very much. And Kathy and I got married on February 23rd, 1991. And just had an amazing relationship. And, you know, as if... there we go. Oh, we just went offline. No problem. When you go back online, just put it back there. Oh, there we go. Thank you. That's Kathy and I on our wedding day, obviously. And let me see if this... Yeah, there we go. And then, you know, God just kept blessing me. I got a family. And I'll introduce you to my family. See, I know I don't deserve this, right? Like, I'm so humbled that God would give me, the way I was living my life, that God would give me this. That's my son, Wyatt. Wyatt is now 23 years old. He just moved to Spain on Tuesday to teach English as a second language and go to school and whatnot. So, Wyatt, great kid. This is my daughter, Ellie. Ellie is a grad student at a university in Ottawa, Canada's capital. And she's taking international third world development, wants to work for the United Nations. Then this is my son, Greg, and that's my daughter, Kristen. We adopted Greg and Kristen. We adopted them when they were 9 and 10 years old. And Greg and Kristen, those poor kids, by the time we adopted them, they came from a very bad situation. Dad was schizophrenic, used to beat them up, lock them in closets, sexually molest them. By the time they got into us, those kids were so broken. But we just did the best we could to love them and take care of them and to give them a safe place and teach them about God. And there was a lot of doctors and therapists and medications, and we got help for the kids too. So it was a really good thing for us, right? And that's my happy family. Actually, we took that picture. We were in Nova Scotia, and we had just gone whale watching. And everybody was sick. Everybody was like, oh my gosh. And you can see Wyatt there is holding a can of ginger ale because he was like so vomitous. Kids were throwing up off the side of the boat, and we get off this boat, and we drive, and I find this nice place to take a picture. I say, "Let's get a picture." They're like, "No, Dad, no picture, Dad. I'm so sick. You don't understand. I'm gonna throw up. Get out of the car. We're taking a picture." "No, Dad, please. Oh, no. Stand right there. Everybody, smile. Boom. There's the picture, right?" The truth is, everyone in that picture is absolutely miserable, but we're trying, right? Look, I'm the only one who's truly smiling, right? She's really happy, you know, like, oh yeah, that was a fun day. So anyway, really grateful for my family. That's my ministry, strengthandweakness.org. I would ask you to check it out. Kathy and I started the ministry about 12 years ago. So nobody knew about my homosexual past. I kept it very private, very quiet, didn't want people to know. Kathy knew. Of course, I had some people in my life that I was very open and transparent with. They knew, but I didn't want people in general to know. After being on a mission team and, you know, really doing better spiritually, eventually went into the ministry, was appointed an evangelist in Toronto, went out and led churches in Canada. Again, only a few people knew about who I really was. And I was sitting in Halifax leading the church there, and one night I was on a Saturday night, and I'm finishing up my sermon for Sunday morning. I know I should have done it earlier, but it was Saturday night. And And so anyway, the phone rings. I'm like, hello. And it was a gentleman by the name of Doug Jacoby, who is a international expert in something. And anyway, in a lot of things. The Bible. International expert in the Bible. So he calls me and he says, hey, guy, this is Doug Jacoby. I'm calling from Russia. I was like, oh, hey. Now, I didn't know the guy very well. I mean, I'd met him at stuff before, but it's not like we were friends. He goes, listen, I have an event coming up in Washington, D.C., and I want to know if you'll speak at it. I was kind of honored. I was like, wow, thanks. Because the truth is, in the Canadian work of our Canadian churches within our fellowship, you know, if there's a totem pole, I was at the bottom. Like, I was just led this dinky little church in Eastern Canada that most people didn't think about, right? I wasn't important to anybody. I was like, wow, you're asking me? Thanks. There's a lot of other guys who are better public speakers than me and more well-known than I am, but hey, you're asking me, so that's great. So I said, sure, yeah, what's the topic? He says, homosexuality and the church. I was like, what? My mind started to race. I was like, what is going on? Like, homosexuality in the church? And I was like, how could he have known? Like, who squealed? Like, this is, right? Like, I worked so hard to keep this private, and now I got Doug Jacoby asking me to speak on a thing on homosexuality. And I was like, how did he find out? And no. And so I was like, I can't believe you'd ask me that. I will absolutely not speak at that event. And I hung up on him. So 10 minutes later, he calls back. He says, from Russia. Hey, what was that? I said, I can't believe you'd ask me to speak about homosexuality in the church. I said, I feel offended and manipulated. He said, why? I said, you don't know? He said, no what? I said, that I used to be gay and that I'm same-sex attracted? He said, you are? I said, yes, you didn't know that? He goes, no, I barely know you. I know, that's why this is so confusing. I was like, well, why are you asking me to speak at this thing? He goes, well, he said, I only have Americans speaking at it, and I thought it'd be nice to have a little bit of international flavor, so I thought I'd get a Canadian. I was like, okay, but there's a lot of other Canadian evangelists, and I'm, you know, a lot more well-known than me. What are you asking me for? He goes, well, I was looking at the flights, and it was kind of cheaper from Halifax to get you into... You know, he'll save $150 if he gets me. I was like, okay, how did I get the subject of homosexuality in the church? He goes, oh, well, nobody else wanted it. So anyway, I remember the night before getting on the plane to go to Washington. I'm typing out this thing, and I had to decide, am I going to do this purely from a theological, doctrinal perspective that everybody already knows anyway, or am I going to stand up there in front of all these international teachers and evangelists and tell them who I really am? And so I had two lessons, and I was writing out the real one. You know, tears are just strolling down my face, and I'm like, can I do this? And when I got there, I decided, yeah, I'm doing it. And so I came out, told everybody who I was, and as everybody, all their jaws were dropping to the floor, and Doug was like, oh my goodness, like, you know. But it went great, and I came home from that event, and I said, honey, I've been afraid for too long. I've been too worried for too many years about what everybody else is going to think. I'm going to stop worrying about what everybody else thinks. My wife loves me, my kids love me, I got a few good friends who love me, and Jesus loves me. If everybody else doesn't like me, what do I care? But there's got to be other same-sex attracted Christians in our churches who are not getting help. And our church knows nothing about how to reach out to these people. So I want to do this. So my wife was like, okay, let's do it. I'm with you. The first thing I had to do was tell my kids. I only had two at the time. I hadn't adopted the other two yet. So I had to tell Ellie and Wyatt. They were 12 and 13 at the time. Then I had to call my family, my sisters. I had one sister who didn't talk to me for a year when I called her and told her. Then I called Doug Jacoby and said, okay, you got me into this. I said, I need reputability. I need somebody to add credibility to me because I'm starting this ministry and I need our brotherhood to pay attention, but nobody knows or cares who Guy Hammond is. And if I start going around saying, hi, my name is Guy Hammond, I'm a Canadian evangelist of a small little church in Eastern Canada, and I'd like to talk to you about homosexuality, nobody will listen to me. But if I say that Doug Jacoby... I'm Doug Jacoby approved, right? And Doug Jacoby is saying to everybody, listen to this guy, then I'll have a shot. Doug said, I'm on. So he helped me get the website up. He's started advertising it. He put it on his own website. And he's the one who got me to write my first book. He's actually wrote the foreword of my first book. And then the ministry just took off and exploded. And the ministry has really helped people all around the world. My initial goal was to find 30 people. If I could find 30 people who are same-sex attracted, I thought that would be amazing. We found 30 people in the first week. And then went past 100, then past 500, then past 1,000. And the ministry just grew and grew and grew to where now we're helping thousands of people in 58 countries around the world. And so, you know, I would ask you to pray for us. Like, the ministry got so busy that about 6 years ago, Kathy and I were like, we can't do both anymore, lead a church and do this. So we're going to quit our jobs and we're going to do this full time. Only trouble was there was no money. I had no support. I had a Canadian evangelist pull me aside and he said, okay, can I just, let me just ask you a couple questions here before you do this. I said, okay. He said, so you're 50 years old?
Yeah.
You have 4 kids?
Yeah.
2 kids with special needs?
Yeah.
Couple kids going into college?
Yeah.
Mortgage?
Yeah.
Car payment?
Yeah.
Okay. How much savings have you got for this ministry?
Oh, no, we don't have any savings.
Where are you getting your support from?
Oh, no, we don't have any support.
He says, and you're quitting your job?
Yeah.
He goes, are you crazy? And then I got really insecure. Because I just thought I was being faithful, but you know, he thought I was like, well, if I'm being crazy, God is going to have to catch me, and if I'm being faithful, God is going to catch me. I just don't know, and I don't care. So for the last 6 years, we've just lived off donations. That's how we've made it. A lot of people give us 10, 20, 30, 50 bucks a month, that kind of thing. And then churches just send money. And every year, I don't know, am I going to make it another year? I don't know. Last year, I'll tell you why I'm here. You know why? Last year, I almost didn't make it. I was $10,000 short. And so I called Rick in Triangle. I said, okay, I need help. The support didn't come in. My wife was sick all year. I didn't travel. I need help. If I come to North Carolina and stand on my head for a couple of weeks, I'll preach anywhere you want me to preach, talk to anybody you want me to talk to. I'll do juggling shows for you if you want. But I need $10,000 and I need it now. So Rick went and talked to a bunch of people, and a few days later called me back and said, get ready to come to North Carolina. Here I am. So thank you. You saved my butt from last year. You haven't helped me yet for this year. You saved my butt for last year. So I would say, you know, if any of you want to support me, my ministry, you just go to my website, strengthandweakness.org, and you can give 20 bucks a month. We're actually looking for 20 people right now who'd be willing to give $20 a month. So if you're like, I can give 20 bucks, no problem. Are you kidding? You don't have to do it till Jesus comes back. Just do it for a couple of years. And if you think you can do that and that's not a big issue, great, please help us. If you're like, I can't give 20 bucks, then I understand, thank you. Then your prayers are more than enough. Not really, but here are the books that I have. This is the first book I wrote that I was just telling you about, and that's available at the back table, Carrying Beyond the Margins, What Every Christian Needs to Know About Homosexuality. The other book I've got back there that will really help you, it'll be for sale today and tomorrow, it's called Tempt Away, How to Defeat Every Temptation Under 60 Seconds, and How to Recover Quickly If You Don't. Actually, tomorrow's sermon will be taken from that book. Great book. I guarantee people, you do what that book says, you will overcome any temptation in under 60 seconds. I guarantee it. It's the best-selling book I have. Illumination Publishers sends these things out by the box load to churches because, you know, they'll get their whole teen ministry or youth ministry or singles. Everybody, you know, they just all go through the book together. It's a great book, so I really highly recommend it. I told the group last night, if you buy that book, it's a guarantee you can overcome any temptation under 60 seconds. It's not a money-back guarantee, but you do get to. And then this is a book I wrote called Messed Up, Proof That You're More to God Than Your Mistakes, where I just talk about how you can be an overcomer in Christ and to really give you hope and victory in your life. And then this book is in here for some reason. The publisher didn't send it, so I won't even show it to you. Okay? But that is a really good book if you want to get it. That's 6 Bible studies on how to study the Bible with somebody who's gay. And you can get it from Illumination Publishers. Okay. I'm going to just... Guys, I'm not going to show the video, okay? I'm not going to show this first video. I'm only going to show the second video. All right? So I'm just going to skip through this. I want you to know that... Oh, you know what? Let's show the video. What the heck? I came all this way. Whatever. So we're going to... We will show the first video. All right? When I was teaching in San Antonio a couple years ago, and while I was there, a documentary filmmaker was there, and he came up to afterwards, and he said, "Hey, I'm looking for a new topic. I'd like to make a movie about your life and your ministry." And Kathy and I thought about it, prayed about it, finally said, "Okay, let's give that a shot, see how it goes, even if it's not a good movie. Like, even bad publicity is better than no publicity at all." But actually, the movie turned out really well. It was nominated at the New York Christian Film Festival for Best Documentary and Best Director, and it was nominated at the International Christian Film Festival in Miami last year for Best Documentary and Best Director. Didn't win, but at least, hey, we were nominated. So, there you go. So, anyway, the movie comes out in the spring, and when we're done showing this trailer, I'm going to tell you how you can get it for free. All right? I'm sorry? Can you say it again? Oh, that's how you think you're going to get 123movies.com? No, that's not how you can get it for free. But you're a smart young man, and when you see, you'll be so excited. Okay, here we go. Here is the trailer to Finding Guy.
I'll never forget the very first time someone invited me to come and speak on the issue of homosexuality. When I arrived at the event, there were angry protesters everywhere. The 200-seat auditorium was completely packed, and many would even shake my hand or look at me. But by the time I had finished my talk, dozens of hands shot up. The room got louder. Some people started shouting. Some were booing. So I just pointed at random to one of the hands at the back of the room. The woman stood up. She introduced herself as the president of the LGBT organization that had planned the protest. What she said, I'll never forget.
My house was right here. This was my neighborhood. A lot of things happened in our home that no kid should have to experience. Yeah, it's emotional. It's emotional coming back here again.
We try to project the image of the perfect Christian family, but behind closed doors, something completely different was going on. I was a preteen when I first realized that I was attracted to guys. At school, I heard kids throwing around gay, fag, and queer jokes. At church, the only message I heard was how gay people were wicked and evil and going to hell. In a vain attempt to find fulfillment, I started having anonymous encounters with men I met at places like the change room at my local gym, parked cars in known gay hangouts. I felt God had let me down. Didn't he see what I was going through? Didn't he care? So what was I to do with God and the church now?
So I don't want to take any more time without any further ado, Guy Hammond.
You see, what's been happening, though, for the last 50 years is that these two groups, the gay rights movement and Jesus' church, have been going like this. We've been arguing against each other. There's been no reasonable conversation.
I've been verbally attacked, laughed at, mocked, protested, threatened, lied about online and in the press. I can tell you it's been both a humbling and a humiliating experience.
Challenges, and sometimes we're not convinced that Jesus is that amazing. We have to be convinced that Jesus changes lives.
All right, Finding Guy. I did not come up with the title. So I'm not supposed to do this, but I'll even give a copy to the movie to Rodney and the elders, and if they want to show it here in the church for free, you're supposed to pay for it, but, you know, how are they going to complain? I'm the guy in the movie, so I can give it to the church here if I want. But if you'd like your own personal copy, here's how you can do that. If you go to findingguy.com, it'll say order the movie, and you put in your email address, and then the movie distributor that has been hired to do this. If you guys could pull up that next, or you might even just want to take it. Yeah, please pull up to the next slide there. Thank you. The movie distributor will send you the movie, but here's how they're releasing it. They're going to release it in 5 20-minute segments, like watching a sitcom. So every day, for 5 days, you'll get an email and say, you know, Finding Guy Part 1, Finding Guy Part 2. It goes on for 5 days, so you can watch it in 20-minute segments. Then at the end of the week, what they'll do is they'll turn off all those links and try to get you to buy the movie. For like $20 or something like that. So go back, guys. I think you can take it to like, maybe I should go back. Maybe you want me to do it? Let's try this. Nope. Okay, I trust you. What's that? What'd he say? Oh. Ah. Wow, that is it, eh? Okay. Thank you, guys. Finding Guy. There's the movie. This, you guys, you're looking at last night's power play. Last night's. You're looking at the wrong one. You were on the right one. That's last night's PowerPoint. That's okay. No problem. Anyway, go to findingguy.com and you can watch the movie for free. Okay? Beautiful. So here's the thing. I'll tell you, it's been a tough year. My wife, Kathy, in August of 2017, was diagnosed with stage 4 brain cancer. Totally caught us off guard. Weren't expecting that. Kathy was a strong, healthy woman. You know, yoga, kayaking, hiking, all this kind of stuff. And, woke up one morning, couldn't open her left eye or move her left arm. And we thought maybe she was having a stroke. And turned out, actually, that... We got her to the hospital and turned out, no, you have a brain tumor. And so they did brain surgery and said, you've got a year to live. And so Kathy really was a trooper during that year. She was really determined just to deal with it in a spiritual and godly way, to really look forward to heaven. I was really struggling. God, why is this happening to us? How can you let this happen to us? We've given our lives to ministry and to helping people in a really difficult area of ministry. We have sacrificed. We have done all this stuff. And this is the thanks you get. My wife is going to die. Like, I really struggled. Kathy's attitude was like, honey, why not me? Like, people die all the time of brain cancer. Like, it's not like I'm special. I'm going to die. It just means I'm going to die a little bit earlier than I had initially thought. And so Kathy really had a tremendous heart, really helped me with my own thinking on it. We really spent the year just really trying to celebrate life, spend as much time together as we could as a family. My kids all postponed high school or university had all moved in with us. And we just spent a year together as a family, went on a couple of trips together, that kind of thing. And then the last several months of her life, things really went downhill. She was put into a hospice. And Kathy passed away on August 13th, this past August. So that was 7 months ago. This is a picture of Kathy and I here. That would have been taken last January. That was when, just before things really started going downhill for her, she eventually became paralyzed and blind and spent the last few months lying in a hospital bed waiting to die. She was cognizant. I was able to speak with her. She just was, every time I'd ask her, she's blind and paralyzed and dying. And I'd say, honey, how are you feeling today? And every time she was like, I'm doing great. I mean, she just, she kind of got to this place where she kind of was straddling heaven and earth at the same time. Like, she was just such a spiritual trooper. And I'm so proud of her for making it. She did it, right? She got there. I'm so proud of her. You know, when she died, I was in the room with her. And just got to be with her as she breathed her last breath. And just thanked God for giving me this amazing woman that I got to live with for 28 years. Me, after the life I lived, I got to live with her for 28 years. Wow. I just thanked God for this amazing privilege of having that woman as my wife. And I said to her, honey, I'm proud of you. You did it. Congratulations. We had an amazing celebration. 600 people from all across North America came, and it was a big deal. I had such an amazing time. So, I'm alone now. And it's a new chapter in my life. But I'm not really alone because I'm surrounded with great friends, right? And people who love me. And I'm really, really grateful for that. So I'm excited to see what God has got stored up for me next in my life. I'm going to show this next video. And the reason why I'm going to show it is because it's actually Kathy speaking. And before you guys play, let me just a little introduction. This is the next video in that series. Hopefully you can get it going. And Kathy can't be here tonight, or today, obviously. Normally she traveled with me, and she came with me all over the world, and she would speak. So I thought, since you can't hear Kathy speak about what it was like to be married to me, I would show a little portion of the movie. This is Kathy speaking in the movie, Finding Guy. And I had gone through a time in my life when I was so insecure in our marriage, and so insecure that I was same-sex attracted, and I was really struggling. And this is Kathy speaking about how she dealt with that reality. Because a lot of you'd like to know, how did Kathy handle being married to a guy who's attracted to men? This is Kathy sharing that.
Seven years after marrying Kathy, I actually became a minister at that church in Toronto. And over the next 15 years, we got the incredible opportunity to serve and teach hundreds of men and women in churches across Canada. As we learned to counsel people from all walks of life, I was determined to be transparent and honest with them about the sins in my own life and the temptations that I faced. But the one thing I could never discuss was my homosexual past or that I was still attracted to men. Even though I hadn't acted out in over two decades, besides telling Kathy and a few trusted spiritual advisors, I was simply too embarrassed and ashamed to talk about it. And just the thought of talking about it brought about fear. Actually, dread is a better word. There was nothing that caused me more self-loathing and regret than the fact that I was attracted to men. I found it completely humiliating. I was in a mental prison. For years, I had this recording going off in my head that was just on repeat. And the message was, "Guy, what's wrong with you that you can't change this? You're a loser. You're a failure. You're disgusting. You're dirty. If people knew who you really were, they would never love you." As I look back, it was an incredibly lonely and exhausting way to live.
For the first 15 years of our marriage, we were happy, we had fun together, but it was obvious Guy was still filled with a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. I knew he was having struggles, but he would never talk to me about them. This was an area we just could not communicate. If I ever brought up the subject or asked how he was doing, he would sometimes shut down completely for days. It was as if he'd gone into a black hole or a cave.
I felt like I wasn't fulfilling my role as a man. I absolutely had joy in my life as a Christian, and our marriage was fulfilling, but I just couldn't seem to get past my same-sex attractions. It was just so difficult.
At one point, Guy came to me and said, "I have something to tell you, and I think you need to be sitting down to hear it." And I thought, oh my goodness, this is it. This is the affair. This is the thing I didn't know about. He started the conversation by sharing with me that he was very discouraged because he had spent the first 15 years of our marriage trying to be heterosexually attracted. He had tried everything. He had studied things. He had prayed and prayed and prayed. He really was apologetic. He was afraid that I was discouraged, that I would be let down somehow, that he was not being the husband that he should be to me. And my response, honestly, was, "What? That's what you've been trying to do? That's where all the guilt and the shame and the discouragement have come from? I had no idea. That had never entered my mind that you would ever be heterosexually attracted. And I don't care. I love you, and I've lived all these years knowing you're same-sex attracted, and it hasn't mattered."
After that talk, I decided that I would no longer allow my insecurities to hurt our relationship and to allow painful secrets to carry on. I even told her about how I was molested when I was 8. She was the first person I had ever told. I didn't realize it then, but as our communication deepened, my weakness was finally becoming my strength.
All right. Great. So, let's talk a little bit about some basic things here. Some things that might help you, and then we'll be done. We'll take a break, and then we'll go in for our final class for today. Just so you're not panicking, the second class is shorter than the first class, okay? Let's start with some basics. The first thing I'd like to talk about is terminology. Terminology is important. Words are important. What one word means to you might mean something than what it means to me, and so it's important we discuss it. You'll notice that I keep calling myself same-sex or same-gender attracted. I never call myself gay or homosexual. Why is that? Well, what is the difference between gay and homosexual versus somebody who is same-sex or same-gender attracted? Well, gay and homosexual infer something that I don't want to infer. Gay and homosexual, these are identity markers for people who choose not to celebrate that lifestyle. And they don't consider it a moral issue. So when people say I'm gay, we automatically know what that means. If I told you I'm a gay Christian, terminology, by the way, which I think is completely antithetical, completely opposite, it's a ridiculous notion to me that you can be a gay Christian. If I said, well, I'm a gay Christian, then you would automatically, or most people would automatically assume that means that I'm also involved in homosexuality, but I'm somehow still a Christian. So, no, I'm not gay, and I'm not homosexual. But I have to use some kind of terminology to be able to describe what it is that I'm experiencing. So what do I say? I say that I'm same-sex attracted because this refers to people who choose not to celebrate or indulge in their homosexual attractions. And it is a moral issue. And so I don't celebrate homosexuality. I don't participate in homosexuality. So I am not gay or homosexual. And in today's world where, you know, you can be a quote-unquote gay Christian, to me it's one of the most ridiculous things. Can you be a thief Christian? Can you be a liar Christian? Can you be a prideful Christian? Can you claim all those things while you also steal, lie, and are prideful and arrogant and still be a Christian? Of course not. Then you can't be a gay Christian. If you're a Christian, then following Jesus means saying no to something that seems very natural and normal to you. And I get it. It's not easy. Trust me, I've lived it for 30 years. But Jesus is my identity. He's the one I've decided to follow. What I'm attracted to is not my identity. Jesus is my identity. And quite frankly, I don't understand why, quote unquote, the gay community enjoys being known by what they're attracted to. To me, it's demeaning. There's so much more to our lives than what we're attracted to. So why would you want to be known as that? There's so many other parts of my life. And so I don't want to be known as a gay Christian. I don't want to be known as a same-sex attracted Christian. I just want to be known as a Christian. Jesus is my identity, right? He's the one I decided to follow. But that's the difference between those two terms, and that's why I don't call myself a gay Christian or a homosexual Christian. And I tell disciples all the time, listen, don't use those terms, because people are going to infer something that you don't mean to imply. And it's not healthy, so don't use those terms. Is there a genetic cause for homosexuality? Well, that's a really good question to ask, and we could spend a lot of time talking about it. But I will tell you, here's the truth. It says 2016. You can tell that's an old slide. As of 2016, we weren't sure. But guess what? In 2019, we're still not sure. Is there a genetic cause for homosexuality? We don't know. Okay? If somebody comes to you and says, no, Guy, I read it. There's a study. I read the study that says that homosexuality is caused by genetics. Then you better ask to see that study. And it better come from somewhere other than yahoo.com. Because I'm telling you, the study does not exist. No serious scientific study has yet been able to prove definitively that homosexuality is a genetically based trait. Okay? We don't know if anyone is born that way. Now, I will tell you, that I think it's actually possible. I think it's possible that it's a genetically based trait. I'm open to the idea, but we just haven't found it yet. Okay? Maybe we never will. Here's what the American Psychological Association says. By the way, a very pro-gay leaning group. This was their stance in 2009, and it continues to be their stance. This is not based on any kind of religion or anything else. This is just what they have to admit. Although much research has examined the possible genetic, hormonal, developmental, social, and cultural influences on sexual behavior, no findings have emerged that permit scientists to conclude that sexual orientation is determined by any particular factor or factors. The Mayo Clinic, Arizona State University, got together in 2017 and did a study trying to prove whether or not homosexuality was genetically based, including transgender issues. And it had nothing to do with religion, purely on science. And that study came out and said there is yet no proof to show that anyone is born that way. Either you were born as a man or a woman inside the opposite body, or that you are a born homosexually attracted. Science has yet to prove this. Now, as I said, I personally believe genetics does play a role. The term I said last night is, I think it's more like this. I think genetics loads the gun, but nature loads the gun, nurture pulls the trigger. And are people born this way? Was I born this way? I don't know, but I will say this. It sure feels natural to me. When people say, Guy, I was born this way, I understand. I get it. Because I never chose to be attracted to the same sex. I don't know anyone who ever chose it. If you see somebody living a gay life, you should not assume that they chose to live that way or that they chose to have that attraction. Now, we are 100% responsible for what we do with our attractions. That we're responsible for. But the attraction in and of itself, an attraction is not a good thing or a bad thing left on its own. It's just an attraction. It's what you do with the attraction. Let's say you're really attracted to red sports cars. Is it wrong that you're attracted to a red sports car? No. But if you go and steal a red sports car, now you got a problem on your hands. The attraction left on its own is neutral in nature. An attraction is neutral. It's not good or bad. It just is. You're not in sin if you're attracted to the same gender. You're not. Jesus was tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Does that mean that Jesus was attracted with homosexual attraction? I don't know. But I can't bring it there. I don't know. But listen, if attraction left on its own is sin, then we're all in really big trouble, because we're all attracted to different crazy stuff, aren't we? So if you're really tempted to steal and you want to steal, and you're really struggling with that temptation, have you sinned yet? No, you haven't stolen anything. If you go and steal, it's the action that's the problem. It's not the attraction, it's the action. It's the same thing with being same-sex attracted. A lot of people think there's no place for them in Jesus' church if you're attracted to the same gender. I'm like, that's ridiculous. Jesus' church needs to be a safe place for people who are attracted to the same gender. Help them live godly lives before the Lord. And you should receive no judgment from anyone in the church. Jesus' church is a safe place for you. So attraction is not the problem. It's the action that is the problem. But it does feel very natural. But here's the thing. Just because, let's say all of a sudden, the Mayo Clinic does discover a gay gene, and they've realized, hey, I was born this way. Let's say that's for real. I don't know what difference that would make to my life. It's not like, oh, I was born this way, I guess I can start living that way. No, Jesus is my identity. He's what I've decided to follow. And my ability to be able to choose supersedes genetics, supersedes emotions, supersedes feelings. God help us if we all start living our lives based on how we feel. God help us if we all start living our lives because we think I was born that way. Well, I'm a liar, just how I was born. Oh, yeah, I'm a gossiper and a slanderer, but, you know, that's just who I am. I've always been that way. I think I was born that way because my mom was like that, too. I'm an alcoholic because I was just born that way. And, yeah, we can all go there. I was just born that way. Well, A, scientifically, no, you weren't. We don't know that yet, so don't use that excuse. And number two, even if you were, you have choice. You don't have to live that way. We're not like a bunch of robots. Oh, I was born that way. Oh, dude, I must go there. Like, come on. I made this point in New York City a few years ago. And when I was saying this, somebody in the audience said, oh, yeah, what about the animal kingdom? I was like, what about the animal kingdom? They're like, well, animals are involved in homosexuality. That's proof that it's genetics. I was like, yeah, but they're animals. Right? They live on instinct. They don't choose. They just live. But see, I'm not an animal. Don't reduce me to that. I can choose how I'm going to live. Yes, I feel like I'm attracted to the same gender. For whatever reason, I feel like that's where I'm going to get my needs met. But I also decided to follow Jesus. Guy Hammond died. Jesus became alive in me. For me to go back to homosexuality would be resurrecting a dead man. And so I can't do that. So I live a life of self-denial to say, this feels natural, but this is right. And I just trust that God's way is the best way. I know Guy Hammond's way. Guy Hammond, all he did was screw up his life living in homosexuality. It was a terrible life. I've been there. No thanks. Been there, done that. But doing it Jesus' way, yeah, it's worked. I can tell you with the gift of 20/20 hindsight, I would not go back to living homosexuality for anything. Homosexuality is one of the greatest lies perpetrated on mankind by the devil because it promises so much, but it delivers so little. But it's like that with all sin, isn't it? All sin promises so much and delivers so little. For the Christian, the opposite of homosexuality is not heterosexuality. It's holiness. So if you're in here today and you're a Christian or you want to be a Christian and you're same-sex attracted, do not spend your life trying to become attracted to the opposite gender. Not everyone will agree with me on this point. That's okay. I think it impoverishes people's faith. I think for you to try to be going from homosexually attracted to heterosexually attracted for the Christian, I think it impoverishes people's faith. Because the truth is, you will probably never change that. You will be attracted to the same gender for the rest of your life. I have now for my whole life. And so I got off that treadmill of trying to be attracted to girls. I don't care anymore. I don't think God cares what I'm attracted to. For the Christian, the opposite of homosexuality is not heterosexuality. For the Christian, the opposite of homosexuality is holiness. That we give ourselves to the Lord. We live our lives trusting in Him. We're not going to live a perfect life, but we're going to live a faithful life just like everybody else. And there's great reward in heaven. Is change possible? Yes, of course change is possible. Does it mean God can't change us? Of course He can. I just think a lot of times change comes in ways we don't expect. Change for Guy Hammond. I had hoped it would be that I would become attracted to girls. That change never came. But other changes come. There was a period of time in my life when I couldn't talk about this to anybody. Now I travel around the world and spoken to over 100,000 people and a movie's been made about my life. That's change. So, you know, accept whatever change the Lord is deciding to give you. It may not be what you want, but the Holy Spirit is working. And here's what I want to say, guys, in closing this class. Use your mess to bless. It shouldn't be just Guy Hammond talking about how broken he is and how messed up he is in hopes that I can encourage a few people to live godly lives. You are all a mess too. Are you using your mess? Are you telling people about who you really are, but using that to honor and glorify God with your life so people can go, wow, that's what you're tempted with? That's what you go through? Wow, I had no idea. And look at how faithful you're living. Use your mess to bless other people. All of us should be able to do that. In 2001, Russell Crowe portrayed the Hollywood version of American mathematician and winner of the Nobel Prize in economic sciences in a movie called A Beautiful Mind. I don't know if you saw that movie, but a really good movie. As a young man, John Nash was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And he spent periods of time in mental institutions to be able to help him through the delusions that he suffered. Near the end of the movie portrayal, John Nash is asked if his visions had ever left him. And I love his response because it comes close to the same kind of response I would have if I was asked, are your homosexual attractions gone? Here's what he said. No, they're not gone, and maybe they never will be, but I've gotten used to ignoring them. And as a result, I think they're giving up on me. In the final scene of the movie Interpretation, John Nash gives his acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize. And here he says, I've always believed in numbers, in equations that lead to logic and reason. But after a lifetime of such pursuits, I ask, what is logic? And who decides reason? My quest has taken me from the physical, the metaphysical, the delusional and back, and I have made the most important discovery of my career, the most important discovery of my life. It is only in the mysterious equations of love that any logical reasons can be found. Similarly, in Guy Hammond's life, my quest for fulfillment has taken me to many places. And I've made the most important discovery of my life. It is only in the mysterious equations of following Christ, obedience, and faith that any long-lasting fulfillment of the soul can ever be found. Amen.